Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Ted Peters. Ted Peters is the professor of systematic theology at the Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary and in Berkeley, California. And he's a part of the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences at GTU, and he's the co-editor of their journal, Theology and Science. Is that right, Ted?
You got it right on the nose.
Okay, good. He's also the author of For the Love of Children, Genetic Technology and the Future of the Family, and the book Playing God, Genetic Determinism and Human Freedom. And that's the one I want to talk about most because it's the one I just read. Glad to have you with
us. Good taste in literature.
How long have you been interested in the theology of genetic sciences? It seems like I found articles of yours way back into the early 90s at any rate.
I was conscripted by my colleagues here in Berkeley actually in the late 1980s. When we applied for and were awarded one of the first ELSI grants, Ethical, Legal, and Social Issues grants from the National Institutes of Health, when the Human Genome Project began. And so our research project was from 1990 to 1994, and I got addicted, and I've been addicted to genes ever since.
In the book, Playing God, you start off by talking about different kinds of freedom. And I found that a very interesting delineation of some of the issues. You talk about moral, political, natural, and future freedom. Can we just, can you give me the nutshell for what each of those kinds of freedom are?
Well, people were thinking, in light of the debate over nature versus nurture, that perhaps if we could explain human behavior according to the way our mommies and daddies raised us or how we were educated in school, that we would be determined by our social influences, or when the Human Genome Project came along, we would be determined by our biological influences. And so what I wanted to do was to take a look at the different definitions of freedom and what we know of as free will, that is to say the ability to make choices between alternatives, seems to be the kind of freedom that is threatened either by environmental determinism or by biological determinism. But there are other kinds of freedom. Political freedom, by that we mean we can take action without external constraint. Future freedom means that we can take action today that will have effects on tomorrow. And then Christian freedom or moral freedom, which is one that almost everybody overlooks, and that has to do with our relationship to God or our relationship to a higher ideal in which we are freed from our inner compulsions to serve ourselves. We're freed to love our neighbor, or we're freed to give our life to higher virtue. And this kind of freedom is virtually never discussed in these debates over determinism. What is discussed is free will, and we wonder, are we going to lose free will? My conclusion is, no, I don't think so.
One of the theological writers who I think gave an initial push to this line of speculation was C.S. Lewis in the book Abolition of Man. He argued that any genetic design of our descendants somehow robbed them of freedom. And it seems like you take a pretty clear line that that's a mistaken way to look at it.
Yes, I think that is mistaken. I have the highest respect for the work of C.S. Lewis in general. He was such an insightful classical scholar. But what he's not facing honestly is that all of us begin life as finite creatures. We're born in a specific time, a specific place. We did not choose our mommies or our daddies. We didn't choose our race or the language we're brought up in. There are many things we did not choose, but we don't think of those as constraints on our freedom. What they do is they simply locate where our free activity will be taking place. And I would think that if we were to genetically program in advance a child, that when that child is born, it would be analogous to what happens to us right now.
So for each of these different kinds of freedom that you talk about, it seems like there is a plausible way that genetics could be used to both constrain that kind of freedom and to expand it. That, for instance, with political freedom, we could give people more of the qualities that we expect of empowered citizens, or we could restrict them. With moral freedom, we could give people the technologies to exacerbate their addictions and their habits, and or we could give them the technologies to take them away.
I would think a genetic technology that would help us to overcome addiction, alcoholism, or if there is such a thing as a genetic predisposition to alcoholism, if we could get that under control, I think a person would feel liberated. The same with any kind of addictive behavior. So on the one hand, we'd be taking control of genetic expression, but on the other hand, the person would be liberated from that kind of action.
One of the kinds of genetic controversies that you address in your book is the gay gene. I've always been more of a social constructionist about sexuality, but I'm begrudgingly giving up some territory to the notion of homosexual predispositions. What is the theological import of the gay gene? It would seem that a lot of Christian conservatives are tending towards a social constructionist or psychological constructionist position and are opposed to the gay gene because they don't want to believe that God designed people to be gay.
I think that you're drawing the picture accurately, that what I think conservative Christians frequently want to do is say that homosexual lifestyle, if that's the right term for it, is a matter of a person's choice. And therefore, if they were right-minded and virtuous, they would choose not to be homosexual. And so it does upset them to think that there are biological determinants. Now, even before we get to genetics, when we talk to gay or lesbian people, many of them, not all of them, but many of them will say, you know, I just think I was born this way, and I can't help myself, and this is my inborn destiny. And when we say that, we have to listen carefully and say, well, if that's what the person feels, then that's probably the case. And so the possibility that there is a genetic predisposition is pretty high. The actual claim of the discovery of a gay gene in 1993 has not really been confirmed. That doesn't mean it's wrong. It means that more research needs to be done. Now, what the Christian theologians need to do is kick this up to a higher level of sophistication. It is just too crude to say, if you're born with it, you're innocent, and if you choose it, you're guilty. I've always thought that to be a fishy argument, because in the whole history of Christian spirituality, and that of other religious traditions too, especially Hinduism, the way we are born is not necessarily the way we want to be. In fact, we engage in spiritual disciplines such as prayer and meditation and the practice of virtue so that our higher nature transcends the way that we were born. Even my mother just teaching me to look both ways before crossing the road and obeying the Ten Commandments is trying to get my higher nature to overcome the dispositions with which I was born. So it's not necessarily the case, theologically, that just because I'm born some way, it automatically makes it good. So what I think we need to do is to place the question of the ethical question of dispositions to sexual behavior, whether heterosexual or heterosexual or homosexual, in the question of the relationship between free will and our biological dispositions.
Just to paraphrase you, it sounds like you're saying the question really is homosexuality a sin or not? Because if it's genetic, it may be a little bit harder to fight your sinful temptations, but there are a lot of sinful temptations which appear to be genetic and which we're called upon to fight.
Or to say it another way, making it genetic doesn't either make it sinful or innocent. It could be either one. So that we'll have to make our decision on the basis of something else.
I'm speaking with Ted Peters. He's a professor of theology at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary and part of the Center for Theology in the Natural Sciences. They are the author of For the Love of Children and Playing God. In this discussion about genetics, one of the frequent phrases that gets thrown out is playing God, and you have a very interesting discussion of how, you know, this is not a theological concept, but what is the import? It's basically an accusation of hubris that human beings would take on the power of creating and reshaping life. And can you talk a little bit about the theology, and you come up with what you call a co-creator theology, that we in fact are empowered by God to be co-creators of nature. But where does this hubris line get drawn, and what's its theological import?
You're correct in describing the contemporary consciousness as being worried that our scientists are going to play God, that they're going to have hubris, which is the Greek word for pride. They're going to have pride, and they're going to cross a boundary. They're going to enter some realm that they ought not to, and nature is going to come back and clobber us. This is the myth of Prometheus in ancient Greece. It returns in the story of Frankenstein, because in the story of Frankenstein, we have the mad scientist who crosses the line between life and death, and eventually then the monster is chaos coming back to destroy us. And contemporary genetics plugs into this myth, and the movie Jurassic Park is your classic example. It's Frankenstein genetic style, because the mad scientist now crosses the line between life and death and fiddling with the genes, and the dinosaurs come roaring back and try to kill us. Well, what's going on in the culture, and again, this is not theology, this is culture, is that our culture is afraid that these very smart scientists are going to be immoral, they're going to be crazy, they're going to use their powers to violate some natural law, and nature is just going to come back and ruin us. It's a form of cultural anxiety. And what happens is that the scientists kind of get scapegoated or blamed for this amorphous anxiety. In its more sophisticated form, such as you'll find in the work of Leon Cass, who chairs President Bush's Council on Bioethics, it comes out as a form of naturalism. That is to say, we have this innate sense that genetic technology is repugnant, and we ought to form ethical principles that say, hey, no, stop, don't cross the line, no trespassing, so to speak, and then we'll be safe if we let nature have its way. So that's the plain God phenomenon. It doesn't come from the Bible. It doesn't come from Christian theology. It comes from pagan mythology, from the Greeks. But it's alive and well, and there is a version in the Bible. The book of Proverbs says that pride goes before a fall, and if you and I have hubris or pride, we're going to mess things up. And so it's a counsel of wisdom, but in itself, it's insufficient, in my judgment, to stop the progress of science.
So you call for co-creator theology and ethics of creativity.
The phrase that I've selected to use here is the human being is the created co-creator, and these are the words given me by one of my former professors, Philip Hefner in Chicago, and the created in there recognizes that we are dependent, totally dependent upon God, totally dependent upon our biological history. You and I didn't create ourselves, we're thrown here. So once we acknowledge our dependence, then let's go on and figure out what are we as human beings? We are creative as a race. Obviously, some individuals are more creative than others. My father was quite creative. He was an engineer for General Motors. Every morning, he got up, he would go to work, and he would invent something hitherto never existing in the history of the human race. Now, he thought he was earning a living. But there he is, creating things, and that's the nature of the human race. The planet today is not what it was when the human race first appeared here. And so the co-creator for me is actually an ethical category. It says we are going to transform ourselves and the world no matter what. The question is, can we do it according to God's will? Can we do it according to a vision in which things are going to be improved? Can human health and well-being be enhanced? And that's what I mean by co-creativity. We are condemned to be creative, and now that we're condemned to be creative, how can we use it to make the world a better place?
Well, the reason I mention Mirandela is that it seems like there's two ways you can go with that kind of a theology. One is a stewardship theology, which says it's okay for us to use our human powers. God gave us the ability to use our human powers, and we can reaffirm the notion of health and use medicine to keep us healthy and make things better in that kind of way. Or a more perfectionist direction, which says that, you know, we have these powers for a reason, in order to achieve some kind of telos, some kind of Taylorian overman or whatever. And that would take us in a much more radical direction.
I think I'm probably right in between those two. I do believe in the telos. I do believe that life can and should be made better through our creative efforts. I also believe in healing. Actually, Jewish ethicists are more intent on this than Christian ethicists, but Christian ethicists are as well. Healing is the Bible's mandate to us. We are supposed to be engaged in healing. And so whether a doctor is an atheist or a devout believer, that doctor is doing God's will according to the biblical vision. Where it gets dicey, where the questions arise, is in medical research, and this is an area that I happen to spend a lot of time and energy in. Should we as a society fund laboratory scientists to try to discover new and exotic medicines which will eventually improve the quality of life for human beings? I want to answer yes, and that's our society's way of being created co-creators with God, so to speak. Because improving human health and well-being, even though it's finite, a finite enterprise, is still part of salvation. Salvation is really a form of grand healing.
So one of the areas that's very controversial in that in genetics is the notion of germline enhancement. And you say, for any bioethicist, much less a theological bioethicist, some very positive things, and you critique some of the arguments against germline enhancement. What are reservations that you would have about going in an enhancement direction?
Well, here I would invoke the precautionary principle that our environmentalist colleagues operate with. The chief argument against germline intervention in general, and enhancement in particular, is the plain God argument. Namely, we might tinker with the DNA, get in there with our wrenches and our screwdrivers, alter the DNA, and lack the vision to anticipate what kind of problems we're going to create. And two or three generations down the line, we might have thrown something out of kilter that comes back to clobber us. So my argument, only argument, against germline intervention is the precautionary principle, which means if we learn more and if we have adequate knowledge, there's nothing intrinsic in the human DNA that should prevent us from altering it to help, say, eliminate deleterious diseases that are genetically caused, such as cystic fibrosis or Huntington's disease or inherited breast cancer. If we could eliminate those defective genes for future generations without any side effects, I think we're morally obligated to do so. So what I want to say is that there's nothing biologically prohibitive to germline intervention. It's more a practical prohibition that we ought to be able to know more than we do now about the possible pitfalls of taking such an action.
I'm speaking with Ted Peters. He's a professor of systematic theology at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley. He's also a part of the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences at the Graduate Theological Union there in Berkeley. Do you see a growing reaction on the part of liberal clergy and ministers to the growth of very conservative attitudes about, for instance, stem cells? Or is it that there's that all of the theological community is moving to the right as this growing Christian conservative movement mobilizes?
I think if we were to make a spectrum of Christians on the right or the left, I probably would be just a little bit left of the middle. I'm not an extreme leftist, but I certainly embrace with other left-oriented people commitments to social transformation on behalf of justice and equality and a better form of life. And I do believe that social institutions should be responsible, and I think there are good theological reasons for holding that position. When it comes to parsing how people are going to think about the issues of genetic research and the value, potential value of genetic research for dramatically improving human health and well-being, I find it surprising that you can't just plot people according to their conservative and liberal positions. Yes, the Vatican and conservative evangelicals do tend towards a naturalism, which I think is surprising, that says, gee, nature ought to stay the way it is, and we ought not to change it, that somehow or other God's will is present in natural law, and that natural law puts limits, so that the task of the ethicist is basically to say no. To be an ethicist, you only need one word, and that's no. But you know, a lot of my liberal colleagues hold exactly the same position, which also surprises me, that they tend to be quite sympathetic to naturalistic arguments that are anti-technological and anti-innovative. And that surprises me, because I don't think the theology of the Bible warrants having an ethical stance that simply says no to things. The God of the Bible creates new things. I will do a new thing, God says through the mouth of the prophet Isaiah. And from the time of the story of Adam and Eve leaving the garden on through the Bible, God is promising renewal. And, of course, the Bible finishes with this grand picture of the new Jerusalem in which everything is transformed. And so the puzzling thing I find about Christian theologians, whether on the right or the left, why they don't celebrate and embrace renewal and transformation more than they do, and why they don't see how science is one of the little ways on which the human race actually has the potential for considerable transformation. I'm going to be cautious. That doesn't mean we're going to bring in the kingdom of God, but it does mean that the power of renewal that God has given the human race is available. And it seems to me if we're going to be good stewards of that part of our nature, we ought to be celebrating the triumphs of science instead of looking for ways to shut the door and close the gate and lock the windows.
I really want to continue this conversation, but we're coming to a close, and I want to follow up on that last point that you made with a final question, and that is that it seems like for many of the left-wingers that I know who have taken a bioconservative position, veered over to join forces with the Christian right on questions like stem cells and surrogate motherhood and things like that, one of the influences on them is the deep ecology movement, the notion of that environmentalism or the ecosystem itself validates a new kind of naturalism, a new kind of naturalistic fallacy. And I wonder if you think that you know, the a part of the rise of fundamentalism in itself is a reaction to what philosophers have called the death of God, the erosion of traditional moral certainty in the world, and people searching for some way to ground their ethics and their morality in a naturalistic move, both in secular circles and in religious circles, and it's leading to this reaffirmation of naturalism.
Well, that's a very insightful question, and many faceted. I think you're right that all of us, not just the conservatives, but all of us are feeling, after the death of God in the 1960s, the so-called death of God movement, that we need to find solid foundations for ethical deliberation and moral commitment. And it's hard to find that in a pluralistic society. And something such as natural law or a return to naturalism helps a lot, and even those who consider themselves biblical, such as the American evangelicals, feel comforted when they can buttress what the Bible says with what nature seems to say. My only problem with it is that it's usually a view of nature that is 100 years behind the time and not one that's contemporary with what the laboratory researchers are dealing with. And so it's one thing to search for a moral ground. It's another thing to actually find it. So I'm sympathetic with that, but the job is not done. I think in part the deep ecology form of naturalism amongst the environmentalists is as a kind of a rival theology. And then what happened, in my judgment, is that got transferred to genetics, that the mindset of the deep ecologists got transferred to the genetics. And so the DNA picks up in genetics, you know, what the planet Earth, Gaia, had done for the environmentalists. It's my own view that in the long run, a good, solid, rational ethic cannot be founded on such things.
Ted, it's been a wonderful pleasure talking with you. I've been speaking with Ted Peters. He's a professor of systematic theology at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary and at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. And he helps to run their Center for Theology and Natural Sciences and co-edit their journal. Thanks so much for joining us. And do, folks, go out and take a look at For the Love of Children and Playing God, the two books by Ted Peters.
Thank you for a wonderful conversation.
Hey,
have a good day.
It's been great.
Bye.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.